name is Yulai Shamiloglu. I'm in the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia, and I'm chair of the Central Asian Studies Program. And this summer, I'm the academic director for the Central Eurasian Studies Summer Institute, which is, in fact, a consortium of a lot of Title VI centers across the United States. And so we're able to function because of support from them. And we also have visitors, not just from the University of Kansas and some local Madison people, but we even have two instructors for Kazakh language from Nazarbayev University in Astana, Kazakhstan, as a part of our Nazarbayev University project. And so we're excited to have everybody here, and we're delighted that we have 11 students this summer. So I've introduced myself. So my talk is going to be The Black Death and Its Antecedent, exclamation point, in Central Eurasian History, an Interdisciplinary Approach. I'd like to emphasize that, so the first half of my talk will be talking about the Black Death in the 14th and 15th century, etc., and using that to set up kind of a framework, and then I'd like to talk about its antecedent in an earlier period, and that's really the main focus. The problem is, as always with the kinds of work that I like to do, is that what I like to do is to kind of figure out new templates for examining data, not just in terms of gathering data and retelling it, but trying to analyze it within some kind of framework. And as somebody who works a lot in the 13th and 14th centuries, I'd say that there's relatively good data for the 13th and 14th centuries for Central Eurasia. And what you'll realize that the data for let's say the 6th, 7th century is more problematic. It's very, very sparse. It doesn't mean there is no data. And what I'd like to share with you is a new way of looking at certain data and the need for certain new approaches. The problem is that this is a work in progress. This is something that I'm beginning to think about. And so I don't have final research results, but I am going to throw out a lot of questions at the very end. So, as always, I like to start out with a few maps. So probably if you're here, you have some idea of Central Eurasia. And so I always have that to come back to if we ever need to go back and clarify a few things. In terms of the natural geography of this part of the world, certainly of critical importance for what I'm going to discuss is the steppe region, which goes across here, skirts across the North Caucasus foreland, skirts across the north of the Black Sea. This area today is inhabited by a lot of different Turkic people. Some of them in Siberia inhabit a totally different ecological niche. The peoples along the area of the former nomadic peoples tend to be over here, including Kazakhs and various Kypchak Turkic peoples. That's my last map. Okay, so the first part, and I hope I can cover this in 20 minutes or less, is to set up this kind of overview, and then I'm going to use this same way of looking at various developments in the past to understand what might have happened in an earlier period. So the Black Death is the famous pandemic of bubonic plague from the 1340s, 1330s on, which arrived in the Middle East and in Europe in the late 1340s, 1346, 1347, 1348, and it had a lot of consequences. Now, I'm happy to talk about this for an hour, but I haven't given myself an hour. So I'd just like to say a few quick words about it, and then show what the kinds of social, economic, cultural, political phenomena that I associate with that for Central Eurasia. So the first thing is just in terms of background, and this is where a historian of medicine would show a flea. But basically, this is a bacillus, so a bacteria that's transmitted by fleas. Humans have fleas as well. They will, try to suck blood from you. Because of the bacillus, they'll get kind of blocked up. They'll regurgitate back into your bloodstream, and then you get the bacillus. There's other ways of transmitting it pneumonically. You spit or you cough. If I have pneumonic plague and I coughed or sneezed, probably all of you would be dead within 24 hours. So this is, when it's called bubonic plague, like the lymph nodes become big, the size of a grapefruit, and black, and people die sometimes just walking on the street and they collapse. Sometimes it's a more protracted phenomenon. But just that's all I have time to say about it. It's very, very well studied for medieval Europe. And so for all these places like Marseille or Florence, you know, there are people who write books about this. There are areas where it was relatively unaffected, and you'll see that on another map too. You'll constantly see a few things like from Asia. The problem is that very, very few people work on this part, and many people reject that this is even something that's worth considering academically, and I'm one of the persons who tries to work on that because it's a really, really fascinating topic. This is a famous map, the Carpentier map. Now, what's really great about the various kinds of maps that people have come up with are nice ways to kind of represent the impact. So if you look at this map, it's really, really difficult. This is that's a classic map. It's difficult to say very much based upon that. But you see, with other ways of mapping it, it's showing, you can see 1347 is for the darker green, and the lighter colors go later on. Areas about which you have insufficient information, you know, it's moving into those areas that we're very interested in. You have some places that were relatively unaffected. And in some places, you could have up to 90% mortality, and you know, basically there's all kinds of predictable consequences when you have the population of, let's say, Europe declining by a third, and it takes a couple of centuries for it to rebound. So, you know, again, my area of interest is over here. And by the way, for example, for Russia, the Russian chronicles have tremendous information about people dying in the streets, and as soon as people hear that the neighboring village is affected, they build churches overnight and so on. But if you open most books about Russian history, it's not included, because it's not a question of whether a topic is important or it's worth examining. If people don't think that a topic is worth their attention or that it's serious, then they won't gather that kind of data. So for Russia, actually, we have very, very good data. This is one of the popular maps trying to show what the spread of bubonic plague might have been like. And there's another map like that. There's problems with these kinds of maps. The question of whether this part of China was afflicted first in the 1320s is disputed. It's a controversial problem in Chinese history. A famous scholar at the University of Chicago, William McNeil, wrote a book, Plagues and Peoples. That was the book that kind of influenced me as a student to kind of become aware of this topic. And he wrote in one paragraph about how the collapse of the Mongol World Empire is related to this. And I've spent some of my time, thinking time, over the past quarter century trying to find data to kind of explicate that in greater detail. When you get to Lake Issyk-Kul, 1338-1339, I actually don't know who this person is, who Snell is, and what he or she read, but there's various interesting things here. One is, yes, some of the important early data we have is from the 1338, 1339, 1341, from around Lake Issyk-Kul. I'll say a few words about that more. This is controversial. For India, I'm not aware of any data for the 1340s. And our great friend and colleague, Andre Wink, professor here, and I have discussed this many times, and he says we don't have any data from medieval India. So, but in the 20th century, bubonic plague has visited India, so that's a problem. And so there's a lot of hypotheses in this map and the previous map, and of course the people listening at home won't be able to see these maps, about, you know, were maritime routes involved in transmission? Was it strictly overland? There are these kinds of problems. So a lot of this, in terms of even suggesting that it's related to the spread of bubonic plague, is kind of conjectural. Not bad conjectures, but it's conjectural. Okay. When I started working on this 25 years ago, basically what I was looking for was political disruption. And so I can explain the collapse of the Golden Horde after 1360 through this, and I try to find evidence or look for evidence for the rest of the Mongol world empire, but there's very, very little evidence for the rest of the Mongol world empire. We can see significant depopulation in sedentary regions. Sedentary regions are affected more dramatically than nomadic regions because, as any epidemiologist would know, that nomadic populations that are thinly distributed, you know, will not communicate disease as effectively. So what we see happening in the 14th and 15th centuries is a sharp decline in urban centers in this part of the world. And maybe there's a slight decline in the nomad confederations, but they become relatively more significant. We see a decline of urban centers, disappearance of many urban centers in the Golden Horde. For example, just think of what happened to Saray, old Saray, and new Saray, or Saray Berke, Saray Batu, Saray Berke, or Saray and Saray Al Jadid. They're archaeological sites that could not continue without a state to protect them. For medieval Europe, we know about unharvested fields, but I don't have any evidence or any written evidence for that. But it does occur to me as I was doing this that we have a lot of information about grain exports through the Black Sea to Italy from the territories of the Golden Horde, and maybe there's data for the amount of imports into Italy from this region. That occurred to me this afternoon. So this is like once in a while I have a random thought that helps me look for a way to get a new insight. And so, okay, I mentioned multiple nomadic confederations. So in the case of Western Eurasia in the 15th, 16th centuries, we need to think about, you know, what is the Great Horde, what is the Uzbek Confederation, what is the Kazakh, the Nogais, the Kazakhs. All of this is related to the fact that urban centers and urban-based states declined. I'll say a few words about cultural and technological regression, a few words about the rise of new vernacular-based literary languages. This is, after all, the same period as, for example, Boccaccio in his Decameron. He's writing about leaving the city to, you know, during a time of plague. It's similar in time to Chaucer, and there's probably other examples too. In the case of the 14th and 15th centuries, we see new mint sites in the territories of the Golden Horde. I have an unpublished paper where I argue for, based upon monetary reforms, that you can make an argument for inflation. For Western Europe, there is lots of evidence for the rise in the price of labor. One of the reasons that fields become untended is because it's too difficult and too expensive to hire laborers, and it's also probably the price of craft of skilled labor also goes up too, and that could be a cause for some of the evidence for cultural and technological regression, that certain things are you know, not being produced anymore because it's too expensive. I should take a time out and say that I actually gave a presentation about this to colleagues in the Department of History of Science and Medicine, and that's one of the few times I've actually talked to people like that. And you know, basically, you know, for a lot of what I'm saying here, this is the generalization. But for every single thing I have here, you could probably come up with counterexamples. So it's a very complicated and nuanced argument. Very complicated in that regard. One of the things that I've been working a lot on recently is a rise in morbidity, you know, fascination with death in general, obsession over death and punishment from God. And as a result, you have an increase in religiosity in this period. And I have some evidence for that in terms of Turkic Islamic culture. And I'm always looking for other kinds of evidence. Now, to hop, skip, and jump through my evidence really fast for this period, so, for example, it's very clear that when the Mongol world empire was established in the 13th century, that you had an empire with sufficient human capital and human resources to directly rule over a vast territory. What we see, okay, so the Golden, I don't have to find any good maps online for what we call the Golden Horde, but so let's say it's roughly this area. So, you know, old Saray, the old capital, the new capital, these disappear later on, for example. So what if you keep this in mind and then go to, for example, the situation in the 16th centuries, you no longer have, not only do you no longer have a single unified Mongol world empire or a group administering a vast state, you have small regional states, and this doesn't really give a good idea of it. So we have the Crimean Khanate down here, and the nomadic forces within it, the Mongats or the Nogais, are an extremely strong force. The Astrakhan Khanate is very small here. The Khanate of Kazan really is just a very small territory here. There's a Khanate of Kasimov, a Khanate of Siberia too. So we know from some studies of Russia that, you know, it's very clear that you had depopulation there. Russian historians of Russia or Russian nationalist historians blame that on the Tatar yoke or Tatarsky Iga and so on. That, oh, they're selling slaves and everything. If you're familiar with the historiography for the Italian maritime republics and their colonies in the Black Sea, there's actually records that show that Slavic population was not the majority of the slaves, and in fact, in many cases, it was the Kipchak Turks and North Caucasians and others. But if one talks about a decline in cities or depopulation in this period, that should be a result of the Black Death. And it also gives the opportunity for understanding what the whole process of the gathering of the Russian lands was. In the case of the nomadic states, the Golden Horde, and those where you had a genealogically based succession principle, the large sudden scale death out of the blue would lead to succession crises, and in fact it led to anarchy and civil war, whereas it's been argued that it actually on the Russian side it led to the strengthening of the Russian state. Now just very quickly, I'll just show you a few of my data points for the kinds of arguments I've been making, and then I want to turn to an earlier period to try to shock you even more. Okay, so one of the really significant areas is Lake Issyk-Kul, and around there you had a Turkic-speaking Nestorian Christian community, and they left a series of tombstones that have been studied by Hwolson and then by other scholars as well. And I'm kind of thinking of maybe trying to do like a complete list of them or so on. My last visit a couple of weeks ago to Almaty, I tried to find examples of these. Somebody told me that the Archaeological Museum has them. The building I went to doesn't have it. The new site for the museum, I went there, they didn't know what I was talking about. Finally, we found one photo. So it may be that I can never even find these. I don't know. And no, you also know the cross on this. But so basically from like 1239 to 1241, there's a sudden spike in the number of tombstones, and then it kind of ends. There's like one random one from 1273. In eastern Kazakhstan, there's a different place where you had a community, and there it continues later. So already that shows that different communities in different geographic areas were affected differently. Another emerging inscriptional or epigraphical literature or epigraphical language in this period were the Volga-Bulgarian inscriptions in Volga-Bulgaria, which is not very far from Kazan now. And so these are inscriptions that were written from the 13th century until 1358. The very, very last one is from 1358. And I've argued that this language, as well, similarly, you had like a few years where you had a rise in the number of inscriptions, and then suddenly after 1358, you don't have any. And I've dared my friend, Fadi Hakimjanov, my colleague, to ever show me one from later than 1358. And 1358 was a plague year, and there's a number of things connected to that for Saray. So in terms of literary languages, or possibly archaic languages dying out in this period, these are two examples, and there's probably others as well. So in the 14th century, we have an emerging Central Asian Islamic literary language coming into being. And then the last one, the Nehjul Feradis, or the Clear Path to Heaven, was written or copied in Saray in 1358, maybe copied in 1360. But 1358 and 1360 were plague years. And after that, you have a hiatus of about 60 years where you don't have any kind of production using this kind of literary language. I argue either here or later that in the case of this particular work, there's no mention of plague. But the question becomes, is there this concern about getting to heaven? And I argue in the case of this work that it's being reproduced in part out of a fear of maybe not being devout enough and emphasizing the importance of being a good Muslim. In the case of Europe, you know, art historians know that, you know, there's all kinds of poses and so on, and there's an increase in religiosity and so on, but for Central Asian people don't write about that, so I think this is just like kind of a hint of indirect evidence. In the case of further to the south in Central Asia, I don't want to dwell on this, but what we see is about 50, 60 years in the north as well, about not having literary production as far as we know. And then you have Mir Ali Shir Navai and the rise of Chagatai. And that's often presented as kind of creating a new language. Whereas if you're a specialist in these languages, you know that, well, it's not a new language, it's kind of a new version. But in fact, this is, I think, an example, and Babur actually says it very clearly in the Baburnama, of that his language is closer to the language of the spoken people, of the people speaking in Fergana. So the career of Mir Ali Shir Navai can be seen as an example of somebody whose writing is closer to the vernacular, as opposed to the traditions of Central Asian Turkic and Old Anatolian Turkic, and I'm not going to dwell on this because I can talk about that at length. But basically, this is an archaic orthographic system based upon Old Uyghur converted into the Arabic script. And then in Central Asia, you continue that tradition, but in Ottoman Turkish, they moved to a simplified tradition based upon Arabic and Turkic. Okay, I should have probably deleted this. There are one or two other examples of texts related to increased devotion. Christiane Gruber, who's now at the University of Michigan, has argued that the Book of the Ascension of the Prophet, which is an illustrated manuscript, was done in part to kind of help convey knowledge about the religion to people who could, you know, perhaps not read. But she I think follows me in seeing this as kind of a response to Black Death in this period. This might be my last slide for the Black Death. So one of the works that I've been working on, it's not a Central Asian work, but it becomes important in the Russian Empire and in Central Asia in later centuries, is the Mawlid, or a poem celebrating the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which was written in Bursa by Süleyman Çelebi, roughly around 1411. And so this is something that I started looking at in part to try to understand what Anatolian Turkish responses to the plague are. And I've been, you know, there are some people who, and it's a work that is, you know, ubiquitous. It's wildly popular in the Muslim Turkic world. It's second, let's say, in the Turkish cultural sphere, only to the Quran as a text, which is recited in the case of celebrations of somebody who's died at feasts and so on. And there's an association between that work and death, including, as I said, you know, when you have gatherings in your home celebrating, you know, the seventh day or the 40th day after somebody's died, you know, this would be read instead of the Quran. And there's all kinds of other things associated with that too. I was shocked to realize when I started looking at Arabic language stories of the poems celebrating the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, that they're about the birth of the Prophet Muhammad. Whereas the Turkish one of Süleyman Çelebi also has a section at the end on the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And so I can't be sure that there's no example in Arabic from before this period that does that, but for me it was a shocking revelation. And the other thing is that one of the attributes given to the Prophet Muhammad is tabib, which in Arabic means healer. And so there's a whole connection issue of death, of healing, of salvation from the fire of hell and so on, which is in this work. And so I think, you know, today nobody, except maybe me, would have any notion that this may go back to the time of plague. But anybody in Turkish culture who's familiar with this text has a very, very clear association with this text in terms of the emotional quality of the simple language, again, a vernacular text, of its high emotional quality and intensity, and also this association with death. So I think the origin of that goes back to that. All right, so now the real shocker, and I'm very sorry if at the end you're not going to be satisfied because I have more research questions at the end rather than finite or final solutions, is the problem of the plague in the time of Justinian. People often refer to it as the Justinianic plague, and I find that to be more awkward in English. This was the plague which supposedly came from Africa during the reign of the Byzantine Emperor Justinian the Great. And this is, you know, like the Black Death, it's something that continued until roughly, a few centuries. Now, so this is a very controversial plague. You know, pandemics, you know, they either existed or didn't exist. So you have some people saying, what plague? You know, there's really, there's many fundamental works about Byzantine history or European history that don't consider the history of plague or pandemics at all as part of the narrative because it's not considered to be one of the topics you would treat. If you're only interested in political history, you might not be interested in that. And when I was studying Byzantine history as a graduate student, the books that I was reading didn't even mention it. So a lot of things didn't make sense to me. So part of my research now is to try to understand phenomena that never made sense to me as a student. How I got here is a whole other issue, but I'm here, and so now I'm trying to help others understand it. Okay, the next thing is, there's a wonderful book that I'm in the middle of reading by Lester Little. It'll be on a slide later on, and in his introduction he points out that people who write long works about or include long sections on the Black Death of the 14th century for medieval Europe barely, you know, will dismiss the plague of the pandemic of the 6th and 7th centuries with just one sentence. So it's like, oh, okay. One of the other issues is that the earliest date, the earliest record is for the spread of it to the Middle East from Africa. But later on, you know, basically, the point of view of a historian of medicine is that something like the bubonic plague is a universal phenomenon. So we have to think of it as having been everywhere in the old world. And so clearly, in terms of bubonic plague, it was in China, but it's very, very controversial. And, you know, one of the problems in studying China is that scholars who are studying Chinese sources are very picky, and they say, oh, it doesn't say bubonic plague exactly. It's a general word for plague or for, you know, disease, and we can't be sure. So there's a whole approach among sinologists who kind of deny that you can even, you know, talk about this. There is one very prominent historian of China, Dennis Twitchett, who wrote in an article in 1979 on pestilence or population and pestilence in China. And so he actually takes this matter quite seriously, and he's saying, well, the first plague occurrence in China was 610. Before that, we have zero evidence for it. And so that's a whole other issue. If you have it beginning in the 540s or 551 and so on in the Middle East, and then it's only in China in 610, if you're looking at the written sources, you know, that's a problem. You can live with that, or you can say, oh, that's not good enough. He points out that you have major waves of epidemic disease, like 630, 65, 682, 707. There's also other, I don't have a chronology here for, that's really problematic, but there's very important waves in Europe and the Middle East, like 730s, 740s as well. I'll get back to that later. And he's saying, okay, it's tempting to see a connection between the Middle East and China in this period, but the big problem is Central Asia, for which we hardly have any data, and maybe we have no data at all. And he cautions that there's no evidence in the Chinese sources establishing that any of these epidemics was an outbreak of bubonic plague. All right, so just to continue or finish up with the controversies, basically, I think his conclusion, or generally conclusion regarding the Chinese sources, is that if a plague is mentioned, yes, there probably was an outbreak of plague. But the problem is, well, and remember, Chinese chronicles are written by the following dynasty, so there's a whole other element there too. But the mention of a plague in the Chinese historical tradition is an ill omen, you know, like earthquakes, plagues, things like floods. And so, you know, if you want to have spin control, if you don't want to have a bad message about the emperor then of that time, then you're not going to, you may omit references to plague. So the absence of a report is not proof that there was no plague. It's and also plagues were also sometimes geographically localized. Another issue in talking about that is that, was it really Yersinia pestis, the bacillus, that was connected to that? And so there's been a lot of controversy, a lot of people have refused to accept that it was Yersinia pestis. Even for the Black Death, there were people who studied viruses rather than bacilli who were saying, no, it was really a virus like Ebola, but there was no proof for that. But recently, there have been studies in recent years examining plague cemeteries in London, in Marseille, and other places where they've actually done DNA analysis, and now actually DNA analysis is possible, going based upon pulp, soft pulp in the tooth, which is preserved. And so the last time I wrote something about this, thinking about the earlier period in 2004, there was no way anybody could be sure. You could stick your neck out and say, yeah, I think it was Yersinia pestis, but absolutely no way to prove that until now. So there's very, very important research. This is earlier. Plague at the End of Antiquity is a book that I just started reading, and it's a real treat to be reading it. Lester Little also has an article in the past and present that's become wildly popular. But the two things that I want to look at and say a few words about, and I haven't given myself enough time to say too much, is this, like Eugen, the transliteration or romanization is very different. So historical variations in mutation rate in an epidemic pathogen, Yersinia pestis, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I had to look up what that acronym is because that's not my light reading at night. And there's another thing that was famous in the news recently on DNA from skeletal remains in 6th century AD. So basically, I can't spend 20 minutes now talking about how one reconstructs the origins of a botanical species or the origins of disease, but it's like the same as for saying that people, human beings, came out of Africa from Somalia or Ethiopia. Those areas where you have the greatest genetic diversity are seen to be those areas from which things kind of branched off. That's the short of it. I'm happy to discuss it later on. So what they're saying here, and if you're really curious, this is the kind of stuff this is. I mean, I went to the Bronx High School of Science, but this is ridiculous. I have real trouble understanding some of this. So I'm going to be showing what's there. So this is real hardcore science, folks. So however, we note that the deepest branching lineage of the genealogy, OPE7, has only been isolated in the Qinghai Tibet Plateau in China, and that most isolates from western and southern China, I'll show a slide in a minute, were located near ancient trade routes designated as the Silk and Tea Horse Roads, which crosses in the Qinghai Tibet Plateau. These observations suggest that plague may have originated in or near the Qinghai Tibet Plateau and was transmitted between rodent populations by human travel along the ancient trade routes. So folks, right now we're talking about a real revolution in the study of the epidemic disease, the bubonic plague, Yersinia pestis, in Central Eurasia, and that article was from January 8, 2013, which means that nobody who published something in 2012 or earlier would have known about that. And this one is more recent. So this is, you know, I have to start to learn how to understand some of this. Here they have the pictures of or drawings of the ancient trade routes. What they've done is they've taken, if I understood, because I have to read the article about another 50 times, is that they take blood samples, probably of antibodies or samples of bacillus, and what they do is they're reconstructing the lineage based upon modern samples, and they're going back, and they're saying, first of all, what they're saying is that not only does the bubonic plague go back to this period, which is a really, really important thing, because for studying the Black Death in the 14th century and later, even whether it has an origin from China or whether it came via Central Asia to Europe is the only vehicle, that's controversial. But they're even able to reconstruct it going back to the time of the plague of Justinian. So what they're saying is that based upon these reconstructions, that going back to the time of the Justinian, the origin of it is here. And I'm going to have to summarize some of it. So this is the clearest evidence that the plague in the time of Justinian originated in the Qinghai Plateau or Tibet. We didn't know that before that January 8th article. And so if it was a universal phenomenon, the way historians of medicine would say, then, and China's right next door, one would have to assume that this afflicted China already in this earlier period, even though Twitchett says that it's the first evidence is from 610. The German article, this article confirms that burials in like the 6th to 8th century in Germany, including Bavaria, contained Yersinia pestis. So now that you've had that, assuming that scientists and specialists in DNA and so on would agree that all of this is scientifically valid, it suggests that you have Yersinia pestis in Europe, in Tibet, and that presumably what you see is applicable. So basically, the phenomenon that you see studied for Europe and the Mediterranean should be applicable to Central Eurasia and China too. I'm aware of the time, so I think I'm going to try to wrap up within 5 minutes, but I have so much more data. This is from that second article, and the European data is related to this. And so this is stuff from Tibet. So it's showing a link between what they found in Germany and what Sui and his colleagues are writing about. So one of the things that they were considering, is this plague originally from Africa? And they're saying, no, the greatest genetic diversity is in Tibet, so we have to exclude the African origin. Plus, they could never find the article that some of this was cited in. The data for Central Eurasia or for the Turk Empire and so on is very, very sparse, and the best data is something like this. So according to the Byzantine historian Theophylactus Simokata, some Turks who fell prisoner to Husro, so the Iranians, had been marked on the forehead with the sign of the cross by their mothers upon the advice of Christians in order to escape the effects of a strong plague. And according to the historian Theophanes, for 588-89, the Turks had on their foreheads the symbol of the cross tattooed in black. And when asked by the emperor how they came to have that sign, they said that many years earlier there had been a plague in Turkey, not Anatolia, Turkey, the land of the Turks. It could have been Central Asia, it could have been elsewhere, who knows? And that some Christians among them suggested doing this, and from that time their country had been safe. This is the best ethnographic type evidence we have, for it. And one of my colleagues, Ann Carmichael at Indiana University, who's a historian of the plague for Florence, says that somebody really needs to work on this because this is actually the first attested origin of using these kinds of signs to kind of protect yourself for talismanic effects. So for a historian of medicine, this is very, very significant data. Now, this is where I'm going to disappoint you, because right now I'm still trying to get my mind around this, and this is what the kind of evidence that I'm looking for, and I don't know if I'll be able to come up with something reasonable in a few months or whether it'll take me another 25 years to come up with something reasonable. It's possible that I'll never be able to come up with something reasonable. So, okay, if we're thinking about some of the categories, and I'm gonna try to finish this within 5 minutes, maybe sooner. So political disruption. So what kind of political disruption do we have in this period? There's lots of different kinds of political disruption. Obviously, you can't read a source and it says so-and-so died and say, oh, they all died of plague. Though one of the two Kagans died in 552 and one wonders. But so, you had all kinds of struggles that led to the establishment of the Turk Empire, and for reasons that aren't necessarily clear, they suddenly go out as far as the Black Sea and so on, and then suddenly the Turk Empire falls into two. Could that be connected to this somehow? Well, one of the things about the emergence of the Jewish Khazar state in Western Eurasia is that we don't really know we don't have a clear idea of how it came into being, but I can easily imagine a region in turmoil where you have chaos because of the Black Death, because of sudden depopulation, because of political disruption, and that it emerges as a state under those circumstances, which means that we'll never have a clear idea of how it came into being. So, like around the 740s, 730s, 740s, there's all kinds of waves of plague in the West, and again, I don't have a clear chronology because scholars have not really put together even a satisfactory history of the plague in the time of Justinian. But so, you know, we see the fall of the Turk Empire and the establishment of the Uyghur Khaganate. Even there's like this kind of the Anlushan Rebellion, the famous Anlushan Rebellion in northern China in 755. This is a time where you have, at least in the eastern steppe, or in the eastern part of Central Eurasia, lots of very significant changes going on in a very short period of time. Who knows if it's connected to that? Can we talk about depopulation and migration by nomads into areas that were formerly inhabited by settlers? You know, people who work on medieval Europe talk apparently about the emptying out of Bulgaria in this period. Of course, we see nomadic groups going into the Bulgars who went into Danubia, then into the Danube region. Did the Turk state suddenly expand as far as the Black Sea because that region was depopulated? We don't have clear data for that, but that's one thing. Typho alert. So Byzantine sources speak of large confederations like the Sabirs, who numbered in hundreds of thousands, and then suddenly they disappear. And so we don't really know. Even for the Mongol period, people argue about what those numbers mean, and they may be ridiculous numbers. But if they were to be somehow reasonable, just even the notion that nomadic groups suddenly disappear, why is that? Decline of urban centers and agricultural population. You know, if for the Middle East and Europe, you have lots of you have lots of evidence for that, but I'm not aware of any evidence like that for the part of the world I'm thinking about. In Byzantium, you had a system arising where you had, it was more like, rather than direct control, it was more like indirect control, like larger military units rather than smaller units. That could be a response to depopulation. I'm not sure if we can see anything like that for Central Asia. What would the impact of that have been on sedentary centers of Central Asia? I can easily imagine the decline of Sogdian speaking urban centers in this period. And is it the fact that depopulation, because of this depopulation, is that what made the Islamic expansion into Central Asia in the middle of the 8th century easier? I've written that for North Africa, and other people have said that for North Africa, you can make a statement like that. For cultural and technological regression, I have no idea why I would look at. But in terms of decline in literary languages and the rise of new vernaculars, the earliest inscriptions related to the Turkic Empire is the Bulut inscription in Sogdian. It includes some words in Turkic. But then later on in the early 8th century, you have the rise of the Turkic inscriptions. Suddenly they're writing the Turkic inscriptions in Turkic and Chinese. Why are they no longer using Sogdian? That could be a parallel, a direct parallel to what happened in the 14th and 15th century. Is it possible to look at the coinage, to look at Sogdian or Turk coinage, and to come up with any kind of argument about changes in weights? Those coins are in such bad shape that we may never be able to do that. Any evidence for increased morbidity and religiosity? Well, you saw in that earlier text that those two Byzantine sources, they talk about the sign of the cross and Christians giving them advice about various things. And finally, this is a period where we have lots of examples of important conversion. So for example, the Uyghur conversion to Manichaeism, the Khazar conversion to Judaism, which could also have political explanations, various things related to Islam. You know, the sources don't have too much. Maybe they have next to nothing. I don't think they have nothing. But what I'm trying to suggest is that we could use a framework like this for trying to tease out a little bit of data here and there. But I don't think we're going to be as successful as we can be for the 14th and 15th century. And then there may be other things, too, that I can't think about. But that's all I'm going to say for now. So thank you very much for your
I'm not afraid at all. Are you prepared to take questions?
Yeah, I can take questions. Which this is really impressive. So we are into the sixth month of the new revolution. Stunned silence. Any questions? Yes, please.
So I get your how you're saying that in China, if they don't want to talk about it, you know, it was the dynasty.
The sources tend not to give too much. Who knows if there were plagues before 610 that were not written into the chronicles? And writing about it is bad PR for the emperor.
So then because I guess I wasn't really aware that kind of Black Death scholars kind of gloss over the Asia, Central Asia connection. So I mean, why isn't there more data, like more connections from non-Chinese areas? Like, why is it something that's just glossed over?
Well, if I understood your question, the real big problem is that for the Middle and Central Asia, there's not very, very much data, or hardly any data. So that's why, for example, you know, Twitchit was saying, well, in the 730s, we have, you know, some plagues, and it could be parallel to the Middle East, but how do you make that connection? You know, people thought that the plague came from Africa. So let me just, I may be doing a really, really bad job at answering you, but so until before I reread this most recently, I hadn't caught on the fact that they think that the DNA evidence shows that this is the origin because of the diversity of, you know, of different kinds of DNA, whatever, profiles or types and so on. And I was thinking, gee, you know, would the fact of the Turk expansion to Western Eurasia in 552 be the element that kind of helped for the transmission? And I was actually looking for that, and then I realized that would be hopeless because it seems to be localized here. But this is, so before I dig myself deeper into a hole in terms of answering your question, this is a totally new, different kind of data. This allows us to propose certain kinds of connections that wouldn't have been possible before just because the sources didn't exist. So in terms of Arabic sources, you have a lot of material. Syriac sources, you have a lot of material. Chinese sources, you have a lot of material. But a lot of the literary cultures that were here in the middle were just emerging or marginal or weren't as well developed. I mean, Sogdians had writing, but there's really like no histories and so on that we could point to, just like commercial documents and religious documents. So it's the dearth of data. And maybe I didn't answer you properly.
No, I think you did. So this study was significant not only because it showed that the genetic diversity located the origin in China and not Africa.
Yeah.
But that it also was the same connection from...
It's the same strain that you find in Europe.
This
strain is what you find in Europe.
Okay.
And this puts the Qinghai Tibet Plateau in a new... It puts it square, front and square in terms of the discussion in a way that people had not considered before. Because for the 14th century, even this was sometimes denied and debated by people. Is it really the case? And if so, the people working on the Chinese side saying, no, there's no Black Death here.
Just for my own information, you're referring there to the Plague of Justinian, right? Not the Black Death.
This is the... Here they're talking about the strains, and this one is going back in time, I think, reconstructing it back in time. So this one was arguing, I think, this one was, okay, look, I have to go back to the title.
You're right. That's...
So this is, they don't really care about Justinian or the Black Death. They're looking at the history of the strain.
Okay.
And it's, you know, they weren't necessarily trying to prove that the bacillus of the 14th century was the same as the bacillus of the 6th century. I'm fascinated by that, and I think it's important for the kinds of questions that I'm asking. But for them, it's like they're saying, oh, you know, it's so diverse back then that, you know, that it had to go back. And so this is, in this time, this is the strain that made its way into Europe as well. So they care about the strains. They don't care about the
common. That could be applicable either to Justinian or the Black Plague. Then, if they're just talking about the strain,
yeah,
it's that's where the strain comes from.
Yeah.
And it could apply to any plague.
And yeah, if I understand, it's very challenging to be a philologist and a historian and then dealing with, you know, right, med school stuff. So, yes, Angela.
Okay, let me try to articulate this and see how I do.
I'm 0 for 2 with my question, with my responses so far. So,
okay. Well, this is a really open-ended one. So, something which I've encountered in researching Western European depictions of the Mongols is that sometimes they are blamed for the transmission of the Black Death into Europe specifically, and the most outlandish account, which I think is completely preposterous, involves some plague flea infested marmots clinging to the underside, presumably, of the horses as they go west. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, hitching a ride for like thousands and thousands of miles, and the fleas hop off and they go and bite people. And,
these know, are from what century?
This was something, I have to look it up because I used it for a thesis source, so it's been a couple of years.
I mean, it's probably not 14th or 15th century. It could easily be maybe 16th or something
it's
later.
Absurd, basically. Mm-hmm. But it ties into this whole demonization of the Mongols, like blaming them for, you know, you have the Tatar yoke thing, you have this potential link with the Black Death, according to some, you have, you know, the destruction of cities and all of this really strange stuff involving ideas of them drinking blood from their horses as they rode in order to sustain their campaigns, and it's all, like, I basically debunk this in my thesis, and there's some good articles out there saying that this is not biologically plausible, but
really?
I was wondering if...
Rudy Linder says that is possible, so...
I'll check that out. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on,
okay,
on the link between the Mongols and...
Sure. I don't have a problem saying or believing that because of the establishment of the Mongol World Empire, which I see as a commercial empire, and that maybe there were trade routes that were either more active or active in this period, as opposed to, let's say, the 12th century or the 11th century, though I'm not sure how one would prove one way or the other. So one of the things is, yes, maybe there was better communication or more effective communication. Fleas can live in saddlebags or sacks of grain for, I think, up to 6 months or something like that. And so, and also this transmission to human beings. Other things is that, you know, there are climatic things. People who work on these topics full time, and I don't, wonder about climatic variation or seasonal rainfall, and, you know, to what extent is that affecting insect life? To what extent does that affect rodent interaction with human beings, because they may get flooded out of their burrows and come into homes or tents and have closer interaction? To what extent does temperature have something to do with that? Also, every year there's new strains. So you have, like with the flu vaccines that we get every year, there's these new strains. And so Yersinia pestis used to be, it broke off from the tuberculosis bacillus. And so, you know, it has its own evolution. And it may just be that in 1338 something happened, like they talk about SARS or bird flu and so on. Something happened here and the new strain just suddenly was far more virulent. There's also issues about, you know, to what extent do you respond differently to a certain disease, like with smallpox, because the second time you get it, your body goes into massive response mode, and that's what kills you, not the actual smallpox. That's what happened during World War I, if I'm not mistaken. And so there was one other point that I was going. Yeah, but so there's a lot of issues of variability, and people are now only now trying to think that you can get some kind of grand synthesis of these various things, and that I still think we're very, very far away from that in terms of thinking about this part of the world. There was one other point I wanted to make, but it escapes me. Going once, going twice. Okay, thank you very much.